Moncrief on News Talk.
With Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
It's early summer on my first voyage, and I begin to sense the vastness of the open ocean. And then, giant fins circling in the water. This is new territory for me. Diving so far offshore, I've no idea what I'm about to encounter. Basking sharks. I'm surrounded by them. My heart leaps from my chest. There are layers of sharks here. Maybe 15 or 16 animals. And all monstrously big.
There you go, that's Ireland's Deep Atlantic. Sunday's 9:30 on RT1. You can catch up on the RTE player. And that's Ken O'Sullivan is the name of the chap we hear narrating it there, who is a cameraman. Though I find it stretches credulity that he just lob himself into the Atlantic not knowing what's down there.
That's the whole point of the show. I guess I found this to be very enjoyable wildlife viewing, and was surprised by how much I enjoyed it, because I kind of thought, okay, here's RTE sort of diving into what is long established safe BBC territory, and it is something that they do so well, and which I've definitely lauded many times, even in this slot, you know, talking about the Blue Planet and so on and so forth. And this is, you know, obviously Ireland's Deep Atlantic, and therefore it is a wildlife show about the seascape to the west coast of Ireland. And I have to admit, I thought it was really, really well made, in the sense that it was beautifully shot, with really, really good shots and very well edited, nicely put together. It was very richly scored, and I thought Ken himself had a great kind of sort of poeticism or lyricism to him in his delivery of things. He would talk about sort of like his, you know, generations of his family growing up on this island off the coast of Kerry or Mayo, I can't quite remember where, and how they had, you know, the sea had nourished them, but they'd never learned to swim and stuff like that. And I just thought, you know, when you're watching a kind of a nature documentary, the whole point of it is it's almost kind of like watching a piece of sci-fi. Like, it's this other world, right?
Yeah.
Like, it is this other world to human interaction and human beings. And in order to create that otherworldliness, the show, or a show like this, has to sort of lean very heavily into kind of being very dramatic in its prose and its choice of words and stuff, and being very, you know, heavy-handed, almost in metaphorical language and flowery language and all that. And it totally got me. Like, I thought it was very hypnotically enjoyable TV, you know. And what I also really liked about it was the Irishness of it. Because, you know, I've seen Blue Planet 2 as a recent example, which obviously is all over the world, but I couldn't tell you if at any point they, you know, dip into the Irish territories, coastal territories or sea territories, I'm not even sure, right? So this looks at the coast around Ireland, and then way beyond, I think, is it as far as 1,000 kilometres, as far as our sort of sea territory stretches, and that is the end of the European continental shelf. So the sea drops from, I think, is it 200 metres to 5,000 metres. And this is this complete other world. I mean, it is essentially another world down there. And it was really intriguing to have this idea of, you know, a sense of Irish wildlife, if I can use that word, you know, sea life, definitely, that I knew absolutely nothing about, that was so unusual and strange and foreign to me, yet my own, you know. I thought that was really intriguing. It was, you know, it kind of is a good partner with the show I was talking about a couple of weeks ago, where they, you know, people are bringing in their bric-a-brac treasures. And these are our natural treasures that we really know absolutely nothing about. So I thought it was quite, you know, quite a patriotic viewing as well, even for, like, someone who's not patriotic like me. But I just thought it was incredibly well made, beautifully put together, and eagerly I'm waiting, you know, for next week's second part follow-up.
Yeah, and I suppose that adds a little bit of credibility to, like, I mean, that Ken O'Sullivan, like, as he said, is his people were hanging off a rock in, you know, off the coast of Kerry,
yeah.
Going back generations. But that kind of the sea, you know, there's almost like a genetic connection
yes.
with the
there's
sea.
There's like an authenticity to the way he talks about the sea. And even though it is, you know, it's thesaurused up a bit, right? But but it's very like you very much get the feeling that this is his, you know, his bread and butter being inside the sea. And you know, obviously, look, David Attenborough is the voice of nature for me, as in, I there are generations. When I look back at my TV viewing, he is just always narrated, you know, viewing or nature rather. But there is a sense here of Ken is literally right in the fray. You know, he's taking the pictures himself. He's putting the whole thing together. He is leading the charge here. Mm. He's diving literally right in. And there's something very kind of like DIY about it put together.
Yeah.
Without it looking like hobbled together, it is very stylishly put together. There's clearly like a budget, you know, gone into this. And it, I think, has been very well received and people have been very impressed by it. So... yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, it's presumably, do you see him underwater, which means
yes.
that there's more than one camera.
That's true. He's got the selfie stick.
It's the magic of telly. Right, speaking of magic of telly, a couple of bits of TV news. There might be another West Wing.
Yeah, so, well, right. Yes and no.
Stress
so
on might.
Might is kind of, yeah. Now, well, although maybe they're just sort of planting the seed here, right?
Yeah.
So NBC's chairman is a man named Bob Greenblatt, who has made it his mission to sort of bring back some of the shows that made the network a big hit in the late 90s, early 2000s. A case in point being Will and Grace, which has already been, I think, renewed for two more seasons even. And the show he says he wants to bring back most is The West Wing, which ran until 2006 and for 150-something episodes and 7 seasons. And people who know the show will know that it has this somewhat checkered history of Aaron Sorkin, Oscar-winning writer of The Social Network, having been involved for maybe the first 4 seasons and then being forced out or left, and then coming back, I think, towards the end, and dips in quality and so on and so forth. So there is a podcast, a very famous podcast called West Wing Weekly.
Yeah.
In which,
we had Toby Ziegler on the show like last week.
There you go. They were here,
in Dublin,
right?
Yeah.
So Aaron Sorkin was on an episode, I think, just earlier this week. And in the episode... I mean, I've never listened to the podcast, but in some ways it sounds awful. Like, it sounds so self-congratulatory. Like, the group, let's all get the gang back together to talk about the good old days. Anyway, Bradley Whitford, Josh Lyman, sorry, yeah. He asked Aaron Sorkin, would he ever go back and do it again? And Sorkin said he had a meeting with Greenblatt 9 months or a year ago, and what had impressed him so much in this meeting was this idea that Greenblatt wasn't doing it for ratings. It wasn't a ratings push, but that he really was creatively behind the idea of bringing back the show because of the current political climate, as if, like, Jed Bartlett is going to right all wrongs.
It's right into the White House and get rid of... Well, Toby Ziegler, it doesn't matter what his real name is, I can't remember anyway. Richard Schiff, yes. Toby Ziegler said that he had an idea for a kind of a reboot of The West Wing, which I think he'd pitched to Sorkin, or certainly he'd pitched to somebody. You know, he wouldn't say what it was. And he said, obviously, you can't have a series of hilarious accidents and everybody ends up working in the White House again. So I don't know how it's situated.
It might be
in the ether.
It is intriguing because the cast has gone a bit all over the place. You know, some of them are just doing TV work. Alison Janney won an Oscar. Aaron Sorkin won an Oscar. Bradley Whitford does appear in Oscar buzzy projects from time to time.
Yeah.
He's in Transparent and stuff
like
that.
Get Out.
Yes, he was in Get Out. So you wouldn't know. I mean, I could see it happening. I could see it happening easily.
There would be kind of a constituency for it in the States particularly.
Very
who
much.
Want to kind of pretend Trump doesn't exist and go back to that kind of nicey kind of feeling that the West Wing gave you. Speaking of nicey feelings, apparently at the Eurovision, there's things that are banned. You can't bring. Is this for the audience at the Eurovision?
Yes. So the Eurovision Song Contest is obviously taking place, I think, the second weekend, or maybe the 18th of May. I'm not sure when the Saturday is. But anyway, May next month, a couple of weeks from now. And it's going to be in Lisbon, as Portugal won it for the first time last year. And they have just released today the most sort of bizarre warning of what the audience is not allowed to bring. So, I mean, there are things that you would expect, like, fair enough, as in alcohol, animals that aren't guide dogs, cameras, cans, etc. But then when you get to chairs, ladders, firearms, knives, syringes, scalpels, any material that has any connotation of political and religious views, racism, xenophobia and discrimination, trolleys, toxic substances, extension cords.
Extension cords is another one, yeah.
You've kind of begun to wonder.
I see flamethrowers isn't on that list, so ha-ha, gotcha. Okay, right, well that's interesting. Right, we do have to take a break. Two more shows to talk about after this. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. James Dempsey is still with us. He's already been talking about Ireland's Deep Atlantic. That's running on Sundays on RTE1. Such a gorgeous programme, says Karen. It's lovely to see such beauty and so close to home. I love Attenborough, but he's always heading off to the Galapagos or wherever. I felt great pride watching it, I must say. Somebody else takes... kind of issue, James, of what you said. Why on earth or ocean would Irish wildlife programs be lesser than the British ones, especially as we have actual Atlantic shores? Well, the reason, and I think James did allude to that, is budget, because wildlife programs are possibly apart from drama, maybe. But even more so than the drama, I would imagine, really, really expensive to make because you can't control it. You have to wait until something happens a lot of the time. You can be waiting months sometimes for something to happen. So that's going to cost you money. And say for Ireland's Deep Atlantic, you have to hire a ship, which I imagine isn't cheap. It's not just walking down the street with the camera, and there'd be a lot of insurance to take into on board as well, and multiple people there for doing all sorts of things that you wouldn't even think of. So it is very expensive. And when the BBC do wildlife programs, and that's all kind of, I think, still based out of Bristol. But that stuff, to recoup the cost of what they spent on it, they have to make sure they sell that all over the world. It's not just they make it and they show it on the BBC and that's it. So fair dues to RT for making a natural history program like that, because it requires some investment. All I can think of is that the water looks freezing. I'd never have done it. Fair play to your man for doing the hard work. Brian in Wexford says, James is making it sound very dramatic. He wasn't in any danger. This is when Ken was talking about meeting basking sharks. Basking sharks are harmless. They don't even have teeth. They just swallow water and filter the plankton out of it for their food. Says Brian, nonetheless, most of us would feel a bit weird if you're just jumping into the Atlantic in pretty much the middle of nowhere. Also, James mentioned in TV news that kind of a vague allusion to perhaps some new version of the West Wing might return. Damien says, I love the West Wing, but it needs to stay as it is. It was perfect for the time it was made and for the political climate. Don't make a mess of it and make me hate it. I love it so much. Says Damien. I think there's a lot of sense in that, Damien. Someone else says, oh God, please don't bring back the West Wing. It's such a terrible show. Only centrist dads with terrible politics liked it. No, I think your centrist dad with his terrible politics liked it. That's really what you're talking about. And someone else says, lately finished The Leftovers by HBO. One of the best ever. Three perfect seasons of brilliant acting and stories. Why did it never catch on here? Best TV show since Breaking Bad. That's a hell of an opinion. It was very well. I must say, I didn't. I think I watched a bit of the first series. I didn't. Though I did read that it was very well reviewed when it came to an end. That apparently the ending of it was very satisfying. But why didn't it catch on here? You don't know. There's so many TV shows now that it's probably hard to schedule them all in, certainly on terrestrial telly. Anyway, we'll move on to our second show of today. It is Westworld, the second series, returned last Monday. You can watch it. So you can watch that first episode. I still think on catch up on Sky Atlantic. It's on Mondays at 2 a.m. and main showing is at on 9 p.m. on Monday nights. Anyway, here's a clip.
I can still help. I know the park a bit. Can I see your paper?
Sector 15. Well, not exactly for adrenaline junkies, more of a family-friendly zone. Cabins, rolling hills, all the pastoral cliches. In fact, I think you lived there for an old role. No offense, but you were wasted as a homesteader. I even saddled you with a kid or something yawn-inducingly domestic. Clearly that didn't take. I remember that you were severely malfunctioning when I inherited you.
She's still there.
Who?
My daughter.
There you go. That's as we're just saying there, season 2 of Westworld. That's Thandi Newton that you heard just at the end there. It does have the good advantage that it gets straight back into the story.
Yes, no.
It kind of picks it up.
So what I hadn't really realised is it's actually been a really long time since the first season of Westworld came to a close, because that was in winter 2016.
Crikey.
And now we're, you know, on the cusp of summer 2018. And when they did the rehash, they did this, you know, kind of, we'll say, 2-minute recap of everything that had happened in season 1. I was really struck by how little of it had stuck with me and how little of it I remembered, particularly when, as I was watching it with subtitles, characters' names would come up before you'd see them and I had not a clue who anybody was. Now, I wasn't the biggest Westworld fan by any means in the first season, because I found it very long and ponderous and circuitry and going around in all these layers of, you know, nonsense.
It was way more meaningful.
Yeah.
You thought it was really profound.
So here's the thing. It's a show that's trying to expose how humans are really the baddies, right?
Yeah.
And in doing so, they've created this world, this Western world populated by robots that have excellent AI. I mean, way more potent or clever than they would possibly ever need to be, right? But that the whole idea is that human beings are, you know, people love to give in to their baser instincts and kill and assault and do all that kind of stuff, right? And yeah, that's obviously what I want to see as a viewer, right? I want to see the shooting.
So they're right then.
They're 100% right. And why won't they give it to me, right? So they start the show with kind of one of the characters waking up, and it's all 2 weeks later after all the fighting has happened. And I'm like, where are my robot? Where's my robot, Malie? Where I sat through, you know, hours and hours of ponderous philosophical, you know, wonk. I just want to see some stabbing. I just want to see some violence.
This is Bernard you're talking to. Yeah.
Right? So this time round, the season seems to be split on two separate timelines. I thought that actually was quite nicely handled. So it did wake up in it's all happened. Tough luck, viewer. You're not going to join the dots yourself. And then Bernard himself is going through some sort of, I mean, it's established what he is already, but he's going through some sort of, we'll say, mental schism. And his timeline is divided between the hours immediately after this robotic revolution and then the 2 weeks, a period of two weeks.
And that's because in the last season, he only finds out towards the end that he is a robot.
Yes.
And he doesn't know, was he always a robot or was he a person at some point?
Yes.
Yeah.
So will they answer that question in short time? Not a chance, right? It's all going to be stretched out and so on and so forth. Now, my fundamental problem with Westworld is, I think its obsession with trying to be clever and philosophical is a bit tiresome. You know, sometimes it seems to have forgotten that at the end of the day, this is television, you know?
Yeah.
And really what I want is, obviously I want some nice, deep, meaningful, ponderous viewing, but I would like some jokes and some action
meantime. Oh, God, not a joke item, no.
Now, this is why Thandi Newton's character is the best one in it, or to me, the most enjoyable, because she plays Maeve, who was this sort of, madam of a brothel who became sentient and aware and was had a previous story in which she had a daughter and was pining for this daughter and had managed to break out and so forth. She gets one-liners. Really good one-liners.
Yeah.
She is like a Peter Dinklage, you know, Tyrion Lannister type one-liners. And she is very, you know, she vamps it up and she's excellent at it.
Mm.
And she's the standout character because she's enjoyable.
Yeah.
She gets to land a punch and to launch a zinger. And you're like, yes, come on, give me more of this. The rest of it is just, a lot of misery. Like, a fundamental problem I felt with the second season is, you know, it opens up with the robots having already massacred all these tourists. But the tourists are as extendable as the robots because we don't even know any of them. We don't know who any of the people are. You know, we there's no sense of loss to the people that have been murdered. You know, they might as well be robots as well for all I care.
Yeah, well, apart from Anthony Hopkins.
Apart from Anthony Hopkins, right? But everyone else is just some expendable, you know, loaded tourist who I couldn't care less about. So
And Ed Harris is still alive.
Ed Harris,
he's a person.
Yeah, true, right?
Yeah.
But that's it. We're like, that's it, pretty much.
Actually, no, because I watched that, and your woman Dolores, mother of God, would you speak in sentences, woman? Everything is, I'm having a dream, and you're in my dream, and all that. Shoot somebody and get on with it.
Just tell me the killing. Just get to the killing.
Because there is, they don't need to do that.
Yeah.
Because and actually, we've done items on this whole idea of, you know, should you have legislation around if you have robots that are lifelike about protecting them, right. Because it brings out the worst impulse. It's a very interesting idea.
Definitely.
You don't need to point it out to people. Just if you just told the story,
yes, it would,
that would point it out to
it
people.
It would do it. Yeah.
But
so, look, I'm looking forward to where it's going because there is the promise of other, you know, zones within the entire theme park.
Yeah.
As in, we know that it's going to go into Shogun Land or Shogun World, which is going to be like Japan, feudal Japan.
Oh, cool.
And there was this some tiger at the one point in the episode who's from. Yeah. Zone 6, which is an unknown zone. No one knows where that's going to be. Mm. But, like, you know, just get on with it.
I think it's between Zone 5 and 7. It's a wild guess. Right, our third show today, another second season. This is Can't Cope, Won't Cope, Mondays at 9:30 on RT2, and you can catch up on Season 1 on Netflix. Here's a clip.
Here you go, madam.
Let me get in the door, life.
Do you think you can quit your job and laze around my house? You have another thing coming to you.
Who told you? It happened like 20 minutes ago. Town, like.
Your language, Aisling, for Christ's sake.
Where are you going?
Out.
No, I'm not babysitting all day.
No,
I have to go.
No, no. As long as you're living under this roof, you'll mind your brother and earn your keep.
Well, what time will you be back at?
Aisling, give over. You're an adult. Deal with it.
Ma'am, I'm
not
going.
Listening. I'm not entertaining this.
There you go. I can't cope, won't cope. Much lauded the first season, though. I don't know. The first season, I think, was much lauded because of the sort of show it was rather than necessarily the quality of the show. And I'm not trying
fair.
To dismiss the quality of it.
Yeah, well, I'll do that. I am not. So I think for me, this is just it doesn't stick its landing. Right. It has these lofty goals. It is a comic drama, but it's only 23 minutes long, which is a very short time to kind of tell dramatic stories and sort of just enough time to tell comedic stories. And it's about two friends who were in the first season living in Dublin. We have Aisling, who we heard there, played by Shauna Kerslake, who people will know from A Date from Mad Mary, which is an excellent film from a couple of years ago. And then Nika McGuigan, who is daughter of Barry McGuigan, who I'm only saying this because, you know, it must be annoying to be the daughter of someone famous, but actually because she's from Kent, and I only heard an interview with her today, and she, you know, she's not Irish in the sense that that is an accent that she's putting on, and I think fairly well, in fairness to her. And she's currently in Vancouver in this new show, and she's an artist or an art student. And what we learn through very quickly in the first season is that Aisling is essentially a high functioning alcoholic, and this is tearing apart their friendship. For me, the issue is that there isn't enough space to kind of land anything properly in the show, in the sense that they don't. When it's going for dramatic punches, it doesn't land them. When it's going for comedic punches, it doesn't land them. It's kind of trying to have its cake and eat it too, in the sense that it's going for these heavy, you know, heavy dramatic, you know, stories about young people in Ireland who might be drinking too much, right? Mm. Which, fair enough. But then it also is sort of kind of plowing this very sort of odd comedic tone where you have really silly characters like her co-worker, you know, being really kind of like just not tonally fitting in with the rest of the show, like kind of slapstick kind of humor. Like in this first episode, she moves in with her former employee or former co-worker who spent the entirety of the first season sitting at her office desk bouncing on an exercise ball to up the ante of how silly she is. You know, for me, tonally, it was all over the place and I could never really get to grips with it. Now, I think I'm one of a few, right? Most people seem to like it much, 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 much more than I do. And Netflix bought it, so it must have some sort of international appeal that is just not getting through to me. But I think fundamentally the problem is these two characters are the main two right in it. Neither of them is particularly likable. And when it is just the two of them, I'm not finding that much to like in it. And I'm not really even enjoying not liking them, you know, in the sense that I'm just sort of, it's just not hooking me.
But the first season was about Aisling and Danielle living together and how Aisling's drinking eventually drives a wedge between them.
Yes.
Now, if they're in two different countries, I would imagine it's far more difficult to maintain that, and they're not talking to each other.
Yes.
It's far more difficult to maintain that initial dramatic tension.
Yeah, so that dramatic tension is being followed up by the fact that Aisling is trying to rekindle their friendship or trying to reconnect with Danielle, and Danielle is not really following through. Now, again, Danielle is the more poorly served character, even in the first season and certainly in the first episode of this season, because in a lot of the time it is the, you know, it's the Aisling show. We get to follow her through Mallow, quitting her job, going up to Dublin, trying to find an apartment, you know, getting essentially conned out of her money, meeting her sister, having a one-night stand, trying to flog the jacket she stole. What did we get of the one in Vancouver, looking at an apartment and kind of not really much more than that? So it's not an even-handed display. Mm. And in some respects...
Well, maybe episode two might be more
about... Yes, yeah. Absolutely, right? But in some respects, it's just as interesting to follow, we'll say, Danielle's story as it is to follow Aisling's story, because we almost want to see, you know, if you look at sort of classic pieces of programming or films or anything that are about alcoholics, it's often the put-upon wife or husband on the side whose story is just as compelling, who has to put up with it. And we don't really get much of that here. We just kind of get snapshots. Mm.
Yeah, I suppose it's assuming that in the first series you've invested an awful lot in these two characters, and so you'll want to know, do they re-establish their friendship or not?
Yeah.
And if you haven't, then you won't care.
You won't.
Yeah. James, thanks a million for coming into us. James Dempsey there. We'll take a break. Back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.